Hello, and you are listening to Eco Justice Radio on KPFK Los Angeles and KPFT Houston. A project of SoCal 350 Climate Action, our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame featuring voices not necessarily heard on mainstream media. Eco Justice Radio acknowledges that we record the show on the traditional territory of the Tongva and all of their relatives. Welcome. I am Jessica Aldridge. On today's show, Deadly Waters, Oil Spills, and the Future of Offshore Drilling, I will be interviewing Emily Parker, coastal and marine scientist with Heal the Bay, and Jack Eit, urban planner and co-founder of SoCal 350 Climate Action. Emily Parker works to keep our oceans and marine ecosystems healthy and clean by advocating for strong legislation and enforcement both locally and statewide. She focuses on plastic pollution, marine protected areas, sustainable fisheries, and climate change related issues. Jack Eit is an urban planner, environmental journalist, and climate organizer, as well as an award-winning fiction writer. In addition to his work with SoCal 350 and Eco Justice Radio, he is founder and publisher of Wilder Utopia, a website dedicated to the question of Earth sustainability, finding society-level solutions to environmental, community, economic, transportation, and energy needs. A thick coat of oily crude from Platform Ellie off Orange County, California, has destroyed critical habitat for endangered seabirds, soiled popular public beaches, poisoned fisheries, and wasted millions of dollars spent on ecosystem restoration in the Huntington Beach wetlands and Santa Ana River mouth and estuary. Just 6 years earlier, we had a similar story off Refugio State Beach in Santa Barbara County, California. Our addiction to oil has us drilling in sensitive ocean ecosystems for some of the dirtiest crude, coupled with a lack of safety measures from aging, corroding underwater pipelines. Sadly, this can make for a deadly mix. Today, we will discuss the impacts of drilling disasters to our coastal ecosystems and communities living and playing on these soiled beaches, wetlands, and tide pools. And who pays for the cleanup? Do we really need to drill oil offshore, and how can these rigs be decommissioned? Really, the question must be brought into when will we stop drilling for oil and gas onshore and offshore, as the time is now to decarbonize our economy and way of life to solve the climate crisis. And who will pay for this? Thank you for tuning in to Eco Justice Radio and our show, Deadly Waters, Oil Spills and the Future of Offshore Drilling. I am your host, Jessica Aldridge, and it is my honor to welcome our guests, Emily Parker, coastal and marine scientist with Heal the Bay, and Jack Eit, urban planner and co-founder of SoCal 350 Climate Action. Welcome to Eco Justice Radio.
Thank you.
Hi, Jess. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for being on the show. And both of you have stellar careers where you've both been intimately involved on issues and campaigns specific to the ocean and fossil fuel related issues. Emily, on October 2nd, there was a major oil spill detected in Southern California. It was off the coast of Huntington Beach in Orange County. It originated from an underwater pipe connected to the Ellie oil rig platform, which is about 4.5 miles offshore. Tell us about this tragic event and what was the cause of the oil spill?
So we're still learning a great deal about this oil spill, what caused it, how much oil was spilled, and where that oil is going. So everything that I'm saying now is still being researched and understood. But what we do know is that sometime on Friday, so that would have been October 1st, there was initial reports of an oil slick off the coast of Orange County. By Sunday evening, October 3rd, the news had broken that there had been a massive oil spill from this pipeline connecting oil rig Ellie to the shore in Long Beach. And at the time, we only knew the maximum capacity of that pipeline. So the spill was estimated to be around 126,000 gallons. Now we have a better understanding of what at least the minimum spill was, which is at least 25,000 gallons. That's the bare minimum that we know was spilled. That's a big number, the number 25,000 gallons. To put it into perspective, it's about 1,000 cement trucks worth of oil that was spilled into our oceans and along our coastline that day. And we're still understanding what exactly happened. But what we do know, due to research done by divers and remotely operated underwater vehicles, is that the pipeline was moved for some reason. There was about 105 foot movement of this pipeline away from where it was supposed to initially be. So we know that something moved this pipeline. And we also know that there's about a 13 inch gash in the side of the pipeline, which is where the oil was being spilled from. There are speculations, and this is being looked into right now, of whether or not it could have been an anchor from a nearby cargo ship that hit the pipeline and moved it and caused this gash. But there's also a possibility that this oil has been very, very, very slowly leaking for a while now. We've heard estimates anywhere between days, weeks, to even upwards of a year. And that this is now sort of the big event associated with slow leakage over time that could have been caused from erosion, degradation, et cetera, from the infrastructure. So we still don't fully understand exactly what caused this pipeline. But what we do know is that no matter what, no matter how well we take care of infrastructure, no matter how many safety plans we put in place, if we continue to drill offshore and onshore, we are going to have accidents no matter what. So we are still getting a good understanding of what actually happened. So where are we now? It's a couple of weeks later. We know that the oil has traveled. We know that there have been at least over 100 animals that have been affected by this oil spill, and countless jobs and people who've been affected by the spill as well. So it was a major event.
I want to get into that in a second, but I also want to first paint a picture. Jack Eight, you have been actually working in this area on some restoration projects. For people that haven't been to this area where the oil spill took place, what kind of environment would they expect to see? Can you paint us that picture? I know, as I said, you've worked in this area for a while now.
Well, thank you, Jessica. This oil spill has had major impacts to the Orange County coast. The spill covered a significant area, much of Orange County, it seems. So the direct hit were public beaches in Huntington Beach. There's a major destination for tourism. The Huntington Beach Pier, famed for its surfing. There's a number of public beaches. Most significant is there's multiple protected areas that have been impacted. Now, there's Bolsa Chica, which is a wetlands area. It's also a major oil drilling area that has slowly being restored. It seems that that was spared because the oil tended to move further south, although that was probably closest to the platform. Where there was much more of an impact is in the Santa Ana River Historic Estuary, in the Huntington Beach wetlands, and the Talbot Marsh is part of that, where quite a lot of oil entered into those wetlands there, did major damage to important habitats for the least tern and the western snowy plover, really sensitive species, endangered species that are trying to get a foothold in this area.
And so there's still a lot of question of the depth of the damage. Areas that have had a lot of money and years of effort have been put to restore these ecosystems. I personally, as you said, have worked for the last 3.5 years on Banning Ranch, which is a 400-acre area that was proposed for a major development. It was defeated at the Coastal Commission because of the important ecosystem that it's part of. And part of that includes that river mouth of the Santa Ana River. And there's multiple areas of the Army Corps of Engineers where they've spent millions and millions of dollars to restore these areas. We still don't know how they've been impacted, but actually there was a dredging ongoing at the mouth of the river, which may or may not have been legal. I think there was some oil intruded into that area. Also, the areas off the Laguna Beach coast, there's multiple tide pools, and further south, a number of important beaches and very sensitive areas.
The interesting thing is already people are forgetting about it as opening up of the beaches, although the fisheries are still closed. People tend to forget really quick, but the environment and those ecosystems, they don't forget very quickly. It takes a long time to have a successful restoration after a major oil spill. So even if they've cleaned up the oil off the rocks and off the sand, it has major impacts, long-term impacts, financial impacts to the economies that are dependent on the ocean there. And this is going to be a real mess, an environmental mess and an economic mess.
Emily, you were talking about how the oil travels and, you know, how far this may have traveled. When oil spills in the ocean, how does it move in a body of water and how far can it travel? And do they know how far it has traveled for this particular oil spill on whenever it spilled, October 1st, 2nd, whenever that may have been?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an excellent question. And at least for this spill, we do have somewhat of an understanding of where it's going and how it's getting there. When it comes to oil spills broadly, it depends pretty heavily on the type of oil that is spilled. There is heavy, medium, and light oil. So light oils and medium oils tend to stay on the surface of the ocean, whereas heavier oils can mix and sink more easily. So how far the oil travels does depend on what type of oil it was. This oil, in this oil spill, we do know it was a lighter oil, so it is remaining on the surface for the most part. The movement of oil after it spills in the ocean also depends really heavily on the weather conditions and the ocean currents. So when this oil spill initially happened, we actually had a very calm sea. It was oddly calm for this time of year, which was a good thing. It did mean that there wasn't a ton of mixing. There wasn't a lot of wave action that was moving that oil around a whole lot. But since then, we have seen an increase in wave height and swell action. So we are going to see a lot more movement with this oil. Here in Southern California, the major ocean current that we have here, it's the Southern California Bight. So it's the southernmost portion of the California current, and it does travel southward mostly. But of course, there are lots of other smaller currents that can move this oil all over the place. So it's really, really dependent on the ocean currents and what they're doing. With this particular oil spill, we are seeing oil from all the way Long Beach to the Mexican border. And when I say we're seeing it, what we're seeing is oiled beaches, tar balls, evidence that the oil has traveled that far in some capacity, some shape or form.
And just to remind our listeners that you are a marine biologist, how and what kind of sea life is immediately impacted by a spill such as this? And is there any wildlife that's not affected in these areas?
That's an awesome question. So the wildlife that is mostly impacted by an oil spill, it's dependent on where that wildlife spends the majority of its time. So with an oil spill like this one, the oil is remaining mostly at the surface. In fact, in the top, you know, few inches of water. And so the animals that are most impacted by the spill are those that spend their time at the surface, which is why we see so many seabirds impacted by oil spills. Our seabirds spend a lot of time either swimming or fishing at the surface of the ocean. And so when a bird is oiled, what happens is that oil essentially covers the bird's feathers and it takes away the bird's ability to regulate its body temperature. And so these birds will actually become really cold. They won't be able to fly. And this is what results in these animals becoming really injured or potentially dying. So that's what happens to seabirds. But there are also lots of other animals that hang out at the surface of our oceans. Marine mammals are also heavily impacted. These are animals that have to come to the surface to breathe. They don't have gills. They can't breathe underwater. We have seen a few marine mammals that have been impacted by this spill. Here in Southern California, that means dolphins, sea lions, seals, those sorts of animals. But the animals that we don't often think about is the smaller ones. Our ocean is teeming with tiny, tiny animals and plant life called plankton, and they spend all of their time at the surface of the ocean. And so these small living organisms can be heavily impacted by oil spills. And these plankton are everything from animals that stay small their whole life cycle, but also the eggs and juveniles of larger animals like the fish that we see. So even though animals like fish that tend to be less impacted by an oil spill because they live deeper down in their adult stages, the juveniles and eggs of those species could potentially be heavily impacted because they're hanging out at the surface. That's where they spend the majority of their time. So it could potentially be a while before we actually know the full impact of this spill on, for example, the recruitment of the next population of our local fish species. What we know about this spill is that there has been around 100 or so animals that have been impacted by the spill that the response team has responded to in some way, shape, or form. So that's around 80 birds, around a dozen fish, and a few marine mammals as well. I should also say that there is a chance that this oil spill didn't impact as many animals as it could have, because the day that it happened, there was an air show in Huntington Beach. And so there's a possibility that that air show may have spooked a lot of the local bird populations, and they may have not been where they usually are, right there on the coastline. So there's a chance that that air show may have been a blessing in disguise, but there's really no way of knowing that for sure.
And how do they quantify long-term effects? So if there is long-term effects to the plankton, to juvenile creatures and eggs and things of that nature, how do we know that that has taken place?
It's a great question. It's actually really, really hard to know. So the way that you'd have to do that is by looking at fish populations over a long period of time. And we're just now starting to understand the long-term impacts from, for example, the Refugio oil spill from a few years ago. That was 6 years ago. We're just starting to look at what those long-term impacts might be. So the way that you do that is by measuring fish populations over time and looking at the trends and changes in those populations. Are they growing? Are they shrinking? Can you relate it back to geographic or temporal specifications, right? So it really does take a long time to figure out whether or not this oil spill had an impact on the broader populations of the fish species that we see in Southern California. So it really depends on the numbers that we're seeing, you know, 5, 10, 15, 50 years down the road.
You had also mentioned the direct and indirect impact that it was having on the community and the jobs where that oil spill happened. What does that look like?
Yeah, that's a great question. Earlier, Jack mentioned that this area is a huge tourism destination. So all along Orange County, we have a number of marinas and harbors and also really popular beaches. So there's a number of different ways that this impacted the community. There's everything from business owners who operate right on those busy beaches who probably saw a loss in their sales or in their visitation due to our beaches being closed for a few weeks. There is also the loss of job opportunities for folks that, for example, use their boats or other marine vessels to make their money. So folks who run whale watching businesses or fishing charters, these boats could not go out because they would have been damaged by the oil spill. Speaking of fishing, there was also a massive fisheries closure that had to happen that is still in place. It stretches many miles along the coastline, and from between 6 to 10 miles all the way out, there's a huge area now where both recreational and commercial anglers can't go. So for recreational anglers, that means, you know, loss of a fun day out fishing. But for commercial anglers, it means a loss of income. It means an inability to go out and catch fish to sell to make money for your family. So we're seeing possible huge impacts on our community. And we're also seeing impacts on access to our beaches, on the ability to even just be at the ocean and enjoy the ocean, which is its own loss in and of itself to the community.
Jack, for the LE oil rig platform that is connected to the October 2nd spill, who do we point the finger to and say, this is your fault?
Well, there's many different ways of looking at this. As Emily said, there's no such thing as a safe offshore drilling rig or pipeline. So we've got an economy that's addicted to oil and it keeps it flowing. So people normalize offshore drilling. They think it's normal to have these rigs. You look off into the distance and you see these lights off. It's sort of romantic looking, but unfortunately they do spill. And the regulators back in the 70s, when they established these rigs, they underestimated the risk here. They did say there's a possibility of the anchor being dragged on the bottom, but they said, oh, it could only, you know, it would be a very minor incident no matter what. And so they did not adopt proper safeguards, burying it further, having them be much better, you know, protected with cement, et cetera. Also, the regulation has been completely lax on these pipelines. I mean, shouldn't we have known that this thing was moved a long time ago? How come nobody discovered that? Is everyone looking the other way on these things? I mean, but let's not get confused and try and blame shipping. Because a lot of people are like, well, it's the economy's fault, or it's the workers, you know, who aren't working enough in the ports, and that's why there's the backlog. No, this is because of oil, and it's because we keep enabling these rigs, which are past their prime, They've been out there. This one's been out since the 70s. Some of them are 50 years old. And they're in very corrosive environment, seawater. And this crude is it's high in sulfur. It corrodes pipelines significantly. So federal regulators a few years ago were rubber stamping permits for, there were 51 permits for offshore hydraulic fracturing and acidization, which is extremely caustic stuff. They're called enhanced recovery mechanisms or well stimulation techniques to extend the life of an already dead oil well. So we face that. And also there's the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act of 1953 that they point to, which says these leases can continue in perpetuity. That is not the case because there's so many other factors that should be considered. And the state of California, it's not only the federal fault, it's the state of California between January 1, 2019 and July 1, 2021, California Governor Newsom issued 138 permits for wells located offshore. And this includes 5 new drilling permits and 133 rework permits. So they're continually working on these existing leases and they're keeping them alive. So there's too many people to point to who's at fault and we need to close these things.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying EcoJustice Radio. We air every Friday at 3 p.m. on KPFK Los Angeles and every Monday at 9 a.m. on KPFT Houston. Stay connected by subscribing to EcoJustice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Deadly Waters, Oil Spills and the Future of Offshore Drilling with host Jessica Aldridge, myself and guest Emily Parker, coastal and marine scientist with Hill the Bay, and Jack Eit, urban planner and co-founder of SoCal 350 Climate Action.
Emily, so with this oil spill, with this relative date of October 2nd that happened in Orange County, and any oil spills, be them offshore or onshore, who has to pay for these cleanups? And are there laws in place that protect the community from bearing the financial burden of these horrific messes?
The short answer is it's complicated. The long answer is yes, there are laws in place that protect the community and protect the environment from spills like this. And the folks that have to pay for the cleanup and the damages from oil spills are the folks that are responsible. So the company that owned the infrastructure when the spill happened. Now, Jack will probably be able to answer a lot of the nitty-gritty details of this better than I can. But in the case of this spill, what we know is happening right now is the company that is in charge of this pipeline is paying for damages. So if folks are experiencing any damages, for example, loss of business or an oiled and damaged boat, there is a phone number that they can call to make a claim. And that claim is then paid by the company that owns this infrastructure. So there are laws in place that protect the communities from these kinds of oil spills. But as we saw with the Refugio oil spill, there are also, long-term lawsuits, for example, that will eventually pay out more money depending on many different factors. So in the short term, yes. Also in the long term, yes. But there's a lot of different avenues that happens. Jack, you can probably help me out here with a little more detail.
Yeah, thanks, Emily. Civil and criminal liability will be the way to get compensation, to get things paid for, to compensate businesses, different entities that have lost, governments that have lost money because of the impacts of this oil spill. There's the Federal Oil Pollution Act of 1990, which is supposed to cover costs. And there's about $35 million in there. Problem is that Amplify, the owner of this drilling site, does not have the resources to cover the impacts here. And they're looking at bankruptcy. It's a serious issue. It's an issue that plagued up in Santa Barbara. We talked about Refugio spill there and how Venoco went bankrupt. And basically, all of what wasn't paid up to that point, everyone had to go into bankruptcy court, which reduces the amounts of what people will get. And it makes a complete mess and extends it out a long time. Amplify is probably facing bankruptcy here. And this is another problem where
we have these operators that really aren't able to take on the liability and the danger of this oil drilling enterprise offshore. On the upside, recent legislation, which was just signed by the governor, enables the California Coastal Commission to enforce the Coastal Act and to levy penalties, the authority to issue fines. These kind of things would happen a lot less if these companies knew once it goes wrong, if the Coastal Commission's coming for us, then we can't do this. That should have been law from the beginning in the 1970s when California did the Coastal Act. But of course, the interests of the many polluters out there made enforcement of the act a little more difficult.
So this is a good change in the Coastal Act procedure.
So future oil spills, they can be charged fines immediately, but it doesn't solve the financial liability problem.
And what about decommissioning? What does it mean to decommission an oil rig? And what is the lifespan of an oil rig? Emily, if you want to take that, or Jack?
Yeah, I can take that one. So decommissioning a rig, if we're going the literal route, is a very complicated process. It's very, very expensive. And these rigs, they are in often hundreds of feet of water. They've been there for a really long time. And the way a rig is built, unless it's a floating oil rig, is that there is essentially all of the production infrastructure sitting above the surface of the ocean on top of risers, these support pieces of infrastructure. And then beneath that, below the surface, is the structure that is actually anchored in the seafloor, which is very big, very deep, and very difficult to remove. So the actual process of decommissioning a platform has like three phases, more or less. You essentially have to cap all of the wells that that platform is servicing. So a lot of folks don't know this. Each oil rig, each platform can service dozens of wells beneath the surface of the ocean. So all those wells need to be plugged. Then all of the infrastructure above the surface of the ocean needs to be removed. So all of the processing infrastructure, essentially where people exist on these rigs. And then you can actually go in and remove the infrastructure beneath the ocean. And you can do that all the way to 15 feet below the seafloor. So it's an enormous amount of stuff that essentially has to be very carefully and very intentionally removed from the ocean. So that's the nitty gritty of how you actually remove it. Now, the process of actually initiating that removal is a whole other story. Decommissioning is supposed to happen through what is called OXLA, which is the law that we have in place that essentially regulates all of the offshore leases that we have. But the actual process of decommissioning a rig from start to finish is extremely complicated. And it gets even more complex when rigs are sold from one company to another. And what can happen is these rigs are sold from a bigger company to a smaller company to a smaller company to a smaller company. And then eventually that smaller company can go bankrupt and they can't afford to decommission the well or the rig entirely. So what we see oftentimes is a really broken process in actually taking these wells, these rigs offline. And Jack, you may be able to provide a little more insight to that one as well.
Yeah. Do you want to add anything, Jack?
Yeah. So big oil companies, they're making billions off public oceans. These are leases of public land. Shell Oil Company was the company that built this set of the Beta offshore. They're the original oil company. They sold off to Era Energy, which is a consortium mix between big oil companies, ExxonMobil and others. And then it was sold, as Emily said, to a number of smaller operators. And they also sell off liability. Of course, this Amplify company and their operator, Beta Offshore, they had a bunch of different violations of laws, even with this lax regulations. They still were violating different statutes and safety protocols. A couple of slaps on the wrist had really been given to them. But the issue here is a lot bigger than just this one rig. We're looking at this process of selling off these older rigs. It's happening in the waters off the Gulf of Mexico of this aging infrastructure, and major operators basically are moving in deep sea areas. Like the Deepwater Horizon is an example of the type of crazy deep drilling that brings in profits for these big oil companies. Of course, the Deepwater Horizon didn't work out so well for BP and certainly didn't work out for the ecosystems and the fishermen and the community around the Gulf of Mexico. In fact, in the past year, there were 200 suspected spills captured by satellites in the Gulf of Mexico around Texas and Louisiana. So these are just smaller spills that are just happening because of this aging infrastructure. And there were a dozen in the Pacific, and there were around 60 in the Atlantic. So these spills are happening. Most of them we don't hear about. And the old pipelines are still in place because the feds don't require enough money to be set aside for decommissioning. They're only required to put aside 10% of the total cost of decommissioning. So, of course, when, say, an operator goes bankrupt, if there's 10% down, then who's going to pay the 90%? And that will be the government. And of course, if they're a dangerous operator, we all pay through spilling. And actually, the estimated cost of full decommissioning across the U.S., $35 billion to $50 billion, but that number could be much more. So the oil companies need to put aside enough money to pay for taking down these rigs. In California, the estimate costs for decommissioning are $1.6 billion for the 23 platforms in federal waters. So a lot of politicians are now talking about, all right, well, how are we going to require the full cost to set aside? Well, that's a harder thing to force, and we can talk about some of those issues.
Yeah, I want to talk about subsidies in a moment, but just one last question I want to throw to Emily. If it costs so much money to actually decommission these rigs, if it's a lot of movement within the ocean to remove these rigs, is it better to just leave them there?
That is a very complicated question. I'm glad you asked it. And I think it depends on a case-by-case basis. My professional opinion is no. I feel very strongly that the companies that are responsible for putting these rigs in place, for drilling these wells, and for opening up our marine resources to the risks of oil spills should be responsible financially and logistically for removing that infrastructure from our ocean. Are there potential circumstances where it makes more sense to leave some of the infrastructure in place? Of course, there's always a chance for that. But I feel very strongly that in most cases, this infrastructure needs to be removed.
And Jack, back to this question of there being money set aside to be able to help with decommissioning, and then also the fact that these oil companies get subsidies. So nationally, the oil companies in the United States receive federal subsidies, as well as a lot of what's called relief money. So in essence, the federal government is sending them a bill for their leasing of the land and extracting the oil, and then massively cutting that bill by millions of dollars. From 2010 to 2018, on average, oil companies received $62 billion annually. In subsidies. And in 2016, the operators of the oil rig Ellie, the pipeline that and the pipeline that leaked in Orange County on October 2nd, were given a $20 million deduction in royalties. This just blows my mind. I mean, is this appropriate? Could these subsidies, if actually paid out by the oil companies, be better used towards shutting down these rigs?
Yeah, the only way these small operators can stay in business is the subsidies. They've got low quality crude and in a very expensive operating environment. And they'll argue, you know, the only way we can stay in business is being on the government dole. Well, the problem is that we should use that money to take them out of business. And actually, the Beta Offshore, the Amplify subsidiary that operated this platform that leaked into the pipeline, they actually received $31 million. In federal relief since 2016. As Jessica noted, $20 million reduced royalties to the government. Basically, they pay some royalties from what they make off drilling. And the government said, you know what? This is the end of life. You're not getting as much oil out of the ground. We're going to give you a break. Here's $20 million. Go spend it how you like. They gave them that discount. That $20 million could have been used to close them down. And then, okay, and they drilled four new wells in 2020, and they gave them a special case royalty discount. I guess the theory is it cost them so much money to drill those extra wells on their lease, and so they needed $11 million from the government as a, here's a bonus, keep working hard. They also got $5.5 million in paycheck protection during COVID. As you noted, Jessica, there's $62 billion annually. It's basically 18% of median producer income, and that's across the board. This industry, not only is it killing ecosystems, it's affecting neighborhoods and people who live nearby, as well as the climate is going haywire because of this. And we're paying these companies to stay in business. That needs to change.
Now, I've read that in the United States, that almost 30% of our domestic oil and 14% of our natural gas comes from federal offshore rigs. And offshore extraction is actually growing at a faster rate than onshore at this moment in history. This is obviously a massive issue and concern, but so is onshore drilling. If we propose to decommission and shut down offshore extraction, will this drive up onshore activities and the associated human and environmental welfare concerns, especially for those living on the front lines? And so if that's the case, what is the real and equitable solution? Emily?
The answer is yes. If we were to push really hard to end all offshore drilling, this could absolutely potentially increase the risk that our frontline and fenceline communities are going to experience an increase in demand for onshore drilling, right? So what needs to happen is a just transition away from all oil and gas, from all fossil fuels, and a move towards cleaner, greener, and more sustainable energy sources. We already subsidize oil companies like we just talked about. And every single day, the communities onshore are suffering from oil and gas drilling that is happening there. And we know from experience, actually, that if we prevent offshore drilling from happening, it will increase the onshore drilling in oftentimes neighboring communities. It happened in Los Angeles, right? When we didn't get any offshore drilling happening in Hermosa Beach, Wilmington got hit harder with more neighborhood drills, with drills and wells in folks' backyards, in the parking lots of churches and schools, right? So what we really need to do is push for a move away from all oil and gas drilling activities, not just offshore. And we need that just transition to more sustainable options.
Yeah, and we should note that California offshore drilling only accounts for 0.1% of U.S. supply. California doesn't bring in a lot of oil, but Emily's point is really important, and we can talk a little later about what's going on with the state of California sort of moving against all drilling. But it is true that there's pressure for more drilling, and there's also the taking of drilling rights when you close down these wells. There has to be, and that's part of the just transition. You need to pay for the operators, and you need to pay for the employees and to smooth the transition. So it's not going to be cheap, but California is definitely committed to it, but not the entire country is not. And as I was saying, some of the biggest operators are off the Gulf of Mexico there. So that's a problem that will be much harder to tackle. But certainly the dangerous operators just off the coast, the ones that have been around off Texas and Louisiana, those we need to include in this solution and close down these things. And the bigger picture of these bigger operators is a very complicated discussion.
You mentioned the words just transition. So for those listeners that are joining us today that don't know what just transition is, can you explain that, Jack?
Well, you can't just say, let's end all oil. We have an economy that's addicted to oil, and we all drive cars. We all operate, you know, gas powered, whatever it is. So there's a process that we have to go through in the consumption side. And there's a process that we have to go through in the labor side. And the subsidies are also a part because the government is addicted. And there's so much power of the lobby of the oil industry because they've been paid so much and they have so much walking around money that they have a lot of say. Even in California, we had so much difficulty getting any climate bills approved this year. There were a couple of them, but most of them went down because of the power of this lobby that is funded by our own tax dollars here. So we have to agree as a society and as a government and for both parties to come together. The Republican members are slower on this transition and trying to deny some issues about climate, but it's undeniable right now what the impacts are from fossil fuels. We're experiencing them everywhere and no one's going to be safe. So the sooner we deal with these problems, the better. And it's going to be expensive, but you can retool in a slower process. And the California, as I said, is doing it. And we can talk more about some of those in a bit.
So a just transition is moving away from building the infrastructure and the jobs necessary to move away from the fossil fuel economy and to move into an economy that has green jobs and infrastructure. I just want to make sure that it's clear for our listeners.
First thing we do is we stop production. If we keep producing more oil, drilling more oil, the tar sands up in Alberta, you know, Keystone XL pipeline, all these ways of, if we stop major drilling, because if you spend all this money on these giant projects, like these pipelines, the Line 3 in Minnesota, you know, you create these infrastructure, then it's going to be 30, 40 years before it's done. So we're 30, 40 years out from actually making the transition. We need to make the transition yesterday, today, tomorrow, every day. So we need to stop production. And then we're talking about cars not running on fossil fuels. And we're talking about how the economy runs. And, you know, there's plastics are an issue. There's a lot of difficulties. We're not going to get rid of oil overnight. So it is a process.
If I may, I recently participated in a workshop on a just transition. And essentially what I learned is that right now we live in an extractive, consumptive economy. And a just transition is about moving towards a circular economy, an economy that protects its resources and its people instead of extracting and using and exploiting those resources and those people. And that goes beyond just the way we get our energy. It's everything that we do. It's where we get our food from. It's how we write our laws and regulations. It's how we educate our children. It's everything goes into this concept of a just transition. And it starts with ending oil and gas production, right? That's one way that we can start that process. But we do have to take into account the communities that currently depend really heavily on oil and gas. I know there are communities where I live in Los Angeles where a lot of the school district in a certain community may be paid for by an oil and gas company. A lot of times there are boys and girls clubs that are paid for by oil and gas companies. And so there is a lot of removing the interwoven connections of these companies from our communities that needs to happen in a very intentional way instead of just severing those ties quickly. So while we need to do it as quickly as possible, we also need to do it with intention and to make sure it doesn't cause more harm to the frontline and fenceline communities that are already being impacted so deeply by these companies and their extractive economy.
And I do want to add, solar panels are a good alternative. Wind is a good alternative. Geothermal, there's a bunch of clean energy sources that are important to be developed, but we're going to have to rethink a lot of things, and we can't replace every drop of oil with renewable energy. So there's efficiency, there's conservation, there's our ways of life need to change.
Thank you. And we're going to go to break and we'll be right back.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying EcoJustice Radio. We air every Friday at 3 p.m. on KPFK Los Angeles and every Monday at 9 a.m. on KPFT Houston. Stay connected by subscribing to EcoJustice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Deadly Waters, Oil Spills and the Future of Offshore Drilling, with host Jessica Aldridge, myself, and guest Emily Parker, coastal and marine scientist with Hill the Bay, and Jack Eit, urban planner and co-founder of SoCal 350 Climate Action.
Jack, we've been talking about oil spills, and specifically the oil spill that happened in October 2021 in Orange County, California, off of the offshore drill Ellie. Is it possible to shut down offshore drilling rigs and pipelines as well as onshore extraction through legislation? Can we do this through legislation?
Yes, it's not easy. We can suspend, then cancel oil and gas leases on the Pacific Outer Continental Shelf through the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management and the Department of Interior based on the risk to national security and the climate crisis, and the danger to natural and cultural resources that offshore drilling presents. And this is one example, and there will be more. We keep doing it. So there's a push for that. We know politically that's going to be a long haul. In the infrastructure bill, Senator Feinstein from California, as well as other politicians, are talking about banning new leases. Well, they're already in moratorium and banning new leases. We're really talking about existing leases. So the push in 2018, there was a bill that barred usage of pipelines, wharves, piers to transport oil from these offshore rigs to the coast. But that, again, was only for any new drilling. It didn't deal with the existing. So what we have to do here is just say, we ain't going to take any of your oil ashore here in California. And that's one way of doing it. And that's State Senator Dave Minn from Orange County area is pushing that along with others. I think it's a good idea. It's also a stretch because of the oil lobby. But now Governor Newsom in California has issued 9,000 drilling permits. That's onshore and offshore since he's been in office. But things are turning around. As Emily was mentioning, the Wilmington oil field, which is south of downtown Los Angeles, right on the coast in the harbor of Los Angeles, it's the third most productive oil patch in the U.S. They got 3,400 wells drilled since 1932. So all these people are living right next to it. And so there's a new drilling rule, and it's something we as an environmental community have been working on for years. The governor already said, you know, we need to move beyond oil, but we need to move beyond words too and proclamations. So this is encouraging. 3,200 foot setback from homes and schools from wells would be banned. Stricter enforcement of regulation on existing wells. The end of sale of new gas cars by 2035. That's a big deal. And to phase out production by 2045. Now that one's a little slower to come, but this is what was just put out. And I think we're getting somewhere with the government here. So I think there's possibilities to push back, and people need to come together to support these politicians and to support these different bills, because the time is now to do something on these issues.
Emily, at the state and federal level, there are these designated marine protected areas. What is protected or managed under these state versus federal designations? And do they protect sensitive environments from oil and gas extraction and other destructive activities?
Yeah, so there are marine protected areas all over the world. And every different marine protected area, or MPA, I'll say for short, has different regulations, different strengths, if you will, different flavors. So here in the United States, we have federally managed marine protected areas, or national marine sanctuaries. And then here in California, we also have a network of state managed marine protected areas that were put in place from the Marine Life Protection Act. So we have both of these different marine protected areas. Now, in the state of California, the state protected areas don't actually talk about oil and gas drilling or protect against oil and gas drilling. And to my knowledge, the reason being for that is that all of our state waters are already protected from any new leases due to a law that had been previously passed. So our state waters are protected from any new leases to allow for new oil and gas drilling. Now, that being said, that doesn't necessarily mean that our state waters are protected from current drilling, right? We do still have rigs in state waters, but this does at least protect these areas from any new oil and gas drilling. But we also have four national marine sanctuaries here off the coast of California. And now those are a little bit different. They don't regulate fishing like our state managed MPAs do, but they do protect against oil and gas drilling. So there's absolutely no oil and gas, or any resource extraction for that matter, including, for example, deep sea mining, that is allowed inside these national marine sanctuaries. And they're a whole lot bigger, I should also say. Our federally managed waters stretch out 200 miles. That's how far out our exclusive economic zone goes, whereas our state managed MPAs, that only goes out to the 3-mile mark. So these four national marine sanctuaries are really big, and they do protect against oil and gas drilling. So that's one other tool that we have in our tool belt, in addition to both the legislative actions and the regulatory actions that Jack was just talking about to protect against oil and gas offshore.
Jack, there's also been discussions about the establishment of a federal Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary that is being led by the Chumash, who are the indigenous people of the central and southern coastal regions here in California. Why is this a big deal?
Well, I've worked quite a bit. I got my environmental studies degree at UC Santa Barbara at a school just off drilling rigs. And I fought in 2008 through 2010 to stop the first drilling lease. They were trying to do the first one in 40 years at Trunkion Ridge. And we fought like crazy to stop that thing and were able to stop it, but it was not easy. Now, the reason that this is important for the Chumash is this area of the ocean at Point Concepcion in California. It's the westernmost point of Southern California where it transitions to Central California. It's called the Western Gate. It's an extremely sacred piece of land. The winds, when you go out there, you feel the sacredness through these crazy winds that blow. And it's in the stories and the history and the cosmology of the Chumash.
A gateway where the souls of the dead enter the heavens on their celestial journey to paradise, Chimilaksha. Well, we know the Channel Islands are off Santa Barbara, but Chimilaksha is another kind of island. It's a land of the dead. So this location is so important to the Chumash that they identify themselves as the keepers of the Western Gate. So they are the perfect stewards of this land and this ocean.
And to put a bunch of drilling rigs out into this atmosphere is extremely damaging. So the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary that they're talking with the Biden administration, it would be 10,000 square mile sanctuary habitat to whales, dolphins, sea otters, kelp forests. And it's extremely important and should be supported.
Emily, what is your opinion on the recent decision to open back up the Orange County beaches that were affected by the October 2nd oil spill? Was the water quality proven to be safe?
So I have mixed opinions on this recent decision. As an avid surfer and beachgoer myself, I understand the haste in which folks wanted to reopen these beaches. I understand why we wanted to get back to our beaches so badly. However, I feel very strongly that this decision wasn't necessarily the right one in the moment. I am not a water quality scientist. However, I work with a few water quality scientists very closely. And the decision to open back up the beaches, we've learned, was based on a water quality report that was released on October 10th. And that water quality report sampled a few dozen different locations throughout Orange County. Each of those locations was sampled once. And those samples, other than one sample, came back without any detectable toxins or chemicals related to the oil spill. And so it was because of this sampling that the beaches were deemed safe to open. Now, my response to that is just one sample from each of these beaches is not enough. We're still seeing injured and dead wildlife from this oil spill. We're still seeing oil slicks and oiled sands. We're still seeing tar balls. So we know that this oil is still there. And my second thought on this is that we actually don't have a standard for closing or opening our beaches when it comes to the toxins and chemicals associated with an oil spill. We have those standards for sewage spills. We have them for fecal indicator bacteria. We know when to open and close our beaches because we have those standards set in place. We don't have them for oil spills. So what's happening is we're making educated guesses. And in my professional opinion, we moved too soon to open these beaches, and there needs to be more data. And we also need standards across the board for when it is safe to close and then subsequently reopen a beach based on the presence of chemicals and toxins associated with an oil spill.
And the fisheries, I think you said, are still closed, right?
That's correct. Yeah, there is still that massive fisheries closure, and that probably won't be reopened for weeks. So if it's not safe to catch fish, is it safe to go in the water? I question that.
Yeah. And I think, Jack, you have a story from a recent oil spill and visiting the area. So I want to ask you, what if people want to help with the oil spill cleanup areas? What information do you have to pass along to them? And why do we need volunteers when the oil companies should be paying for the cleanup?
Well, I totally understand people's desire to step up for the coast. And I think that it is potentially dangerous. During the 2015 Refugios spill in Santa Barbara, I wanted to, as I said, I have a deep history of going out there and I know the area well. So I went down to visit the beach. It was a swarm of people wearing the gas masks and white suits. And it was all closed off. It was like this crazy process. It was not a place for your average person to walk in with a couple of paper towels and saying, where can I help? But I stole my way in there and I parked along the freeway and went down to the beach. And it was pretty brutal what I saw at the beach, because the rocks and were all covered in thick black crude. But it was a little bit after the spill had happened. And so it was awful to look at. And I left immediately and I was almost ticketed. The police came after me. They said, "What are you doing here?" And they let me off. But later on in the day, I had a massive headache. And I was only out there for, you know, just a brief visit to take some photos. And so imagine if you spend a full day there, you would absolutely need protection, gas mask, and a full suit. So I think there's some organizations who are doing that type of cleanup. But I think that just going down there, and I agree that maybe it's early to open some of those beaches. Maybe, you know, I'm not out there sampling the water, but I know it's potentially very dangerous.
But just going back, and yes, I just want to reiterate, if people do want to help, there are groups that are putting that together. You need to be connected with those groups. You should not be going out there by yourself. You need to have the right protection on. I don't know, Emily, if you wanted to add something to that. And I still want to bring it back to that question where I said, why do we need volunteers if the oil companies should be paying for the cleanup? So, Emily.
Yeah, that's an awesome question. And I think the reason, I think actually we don't need volunteers. I think there's an enormous amount of interest from the public in helping respond to this oil spill, which is a beautiful thing. It shows the altruism of our community, which is wonderful. As far as I know, the Unified Command, which is a conglomerate of the oil spill company that is responsible for the spill, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Coast Guard, et cetera, that are responding to this spill, have already solicited for volunteers and have already received 10,000 interested folks who would like to come and be trained and help with the spill response. But do we need these volunteers? Not necessarily, because there are hundreds of trained personnel that are out there actually cleaning this beach, and that is being paid for by the oil company that is responsible for the spill. So, for example, the organization that I work for has received a number of requests from donors asking where can they send money, and we've been saying, don't send money. We don't want the public feeling responsible either financially or in any other way for paying for this bill. That is the oil company's responsibility. I should also say that the reason that folks should not be going out there on their own is because this spill is dangerous. This spill isn't just crude oil, right? When we extract oil and gas from the ground, the companies that do so don't just then transport the crude oil by itself. It also has chemicals in it. And we usually don't even know what those chemicals are because of trade secrets laws. So we often have no idea what's in this stuff, and it's nasty. It can make you very sick. So I'm just going to reiterate what you just said, Jess. Unless you're trained response personnel, don't go help. This is a job for the responsible party and a job for the people who are trained to do it.
Emily, how do you respond to the mayor of Huntington Beach who made the comment, "Well, it could have been worse"?
I respond with, "Well, of course, it could always have been worse. That doesn't mean what happened wasn't bad." And this was an isolated incident. And luckily, there has been good response to this incident so far. There wasn't great, you know, unified response at the very beginning, and there wasn't great public information sharing at the beginning. We now know that this information should have been shared much earlier than it was. However, this was a single incident. And my immediate thought is that there are communities here, for example, where I live in Los Angeles, who live with the impacts of oil and gas drilling every single day. So right now we're all experiencing this you know, singular response of an oil spill happening off our coast, and it's horrifying. But to refer to it as it could have been worse, there are frontline and fenceline communities that are dealing with the impacts of this industry every single day. They are getting sick. They are dying. This is a reality every single day. And for the most part, those communities are low-income communities and communities of color who are bearing the brunt of this pollution. So my response to that is, who cares if it could have been worse? We need to do better.
Thank you. And last question for both of you before we wrap up the show here. Where can people get more information on your organizations and any upcoming actions or campaigns or any other resources that you would like to recommend? Jack, maybe I'll start with you.
Yes, well, we're at SoCal350.org, and of course, this EcoJusticeRadio.org. But in terms of stepping up and participating in the issues that Emily underlined right there, the neighborhood drilling impacts of, you know, the people who live right next to these processing facilities, they have an oil spill every day. They experience this stuff out their windows. So for local in Los Angeles area, there's Stand LA. It's Stand Together Against Neighborhood Drilling. And they're trying to outlaw drilling in the city of Los Angeles, which is totally an oil town. And that's a process that's ongoing, and that needs support. That needs people stepping up and being part of the advocacy to the city people. And on the statewide, there's Vision California, and they're the ones who are celebrating a little bit, but we still need to look at some details, and we still need to make sure that these new regulations will pertain not just to anything new, but existing wells. You know, the setbacks of 3,200 feet, these health and safety buffers are important, and they need to happen. And it will close down a significant amount of drilling if it is done right. And of course, there will be payments to those people and the whole process. So it needs support. Vision California is that organization.
And I know we have people listening in from Houston and all over. I just want to also recommend the Center for International Environmental Law and following them and what they've been doing in Texas and around the world, around the United States as well. And Emily, where can people get more information?
I have to throw in one other Texas organization for you, which is Tejas. They're amazing and do some incredible environmental justice work in Texas. And then I also want to throw in another California group that Heal the Bay, my organization, is a member of, which is the Last Chance Alliance. It's a coalition of organizations across the state of California that is working to build a fossil-free future for the state of California. And their website is great. I highly recommend checking that website out for all kinds of calls to action to get involved in this fight against oil and gas drilling. To follow my organization, you can go to healthebay.org. I recommend following us on all social media channels. We're really active on there, and that's how we let the public know about everything from calls to action to environmental concerns, spills. We're keeping the public informed the best we can through those social media channels and through our blog. And then I also recommend, if you want to follow the actual official response to this oil spill, you can go to SoCalSpillResponse.com. That's the official account that is actually tracking everything that's going on with this specific oil spill. So thanks, Jess.
Well, thank you to both of you for being here today and for enlightening us on this issue and what's going on and how people can get involved and understanding more about what's really happening with these offshore drills. You know, I didn't know that there was many different oil wells underneath of a rig. So I thank both of you for being here today. And thank you to our listeners. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jess.
Thank you.
Thank you to our guests, Emily Parker and Jack Eye, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. This has been Deadly Waters, Oil Spills and the Future of Offshore Drilling. Please connect with us on social media at EcoJustice Radio SoCal 350 and Adventures in Waste. If you like what you heard and you want others to be informed, then you know what to do. Subscribe to our podcast, share the episodes, and get that knowledge out there. And help us continue our efforts by making a donation to the show at ecojusticeradio.org. You have been listening to EcoJustice Radio on KPFK Los Angeles and KPFT Houston. A project of SoCal 350, this show can be found on kpfk.org, kpft.org, all major podcast apps, and at ecojusticeradio.org. Created by Mark and J.P. Morris, executive producer Jack Eye, producer and co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, engineer Blake Lampkin, and original music by Javier Cadre. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.